Hello and welcome to another episode of our Surrogacy Podcast. In this episode, we're discussing the unexpected issues that can arise from pregnancy during surrogacy. I'm joined by two couples today, Dean and James and Carl and Nick, so welcome to you all. Dean and James, we'll start with you. Could you tell us a little bit about yourselves, your surrogacy journey, when it started and where we find you today?
So hello, I'm Dean. I'm James. And we started our surrogacy journey in 2018. We met our surrogate Gemma in 2019. Our twin girls, Nora and Neve, were born in May 2021. And now they're two years old and...
Yeah, two and a half, 2 years
and being
old.
Toddlers.
Thank you, guys. If I could pass over now to Carl and Nick, if you guys could tell us a little bit about your journey, please.
We started our surrogacy journey in 2017 and formed our first team in the same year?
Yes.
Yeah, in the same year. And by sort of early 2019, that team had dissolved and we met Gemma, our surrogate who carried our boys for us. Also was born in... February 21. Felix was born in January this year. So we've got a just over 2.5-year-old and a 7-month-old as well.
So it sounds like all of you guys have had your hands full, I can imagine.
Yes. Yes. Very tired.
So if I can hand back to Dean and James, when were you told that there may be issues during the pregnancy and how did that news affect you guys?
It's a bit complicated, really, because James would say that we didn't know until birth... because the issues that Neve has weren't actually diagnosed until she was born. However, there were issues pre-birth that was a bit of an experience to go through. So Neve's got a right aortic arch, mm-hmm. and we went for our
20-week scan.
It was a 20-week scan. But
which was at 19 weeks.
Yeah, so we had a 20-week scan, but at 19 weeks, and they couldn't find the measurement for, I think it was the spine and the heart.
Yeah, for twin two, which was Neve. They got everything for Nora, who's twin one, and then twin two. As twins are, they're awkward in the womb, but they couldn't get everything on that first pass. So they said, come back in a day or two. Then Gemma caught COVID, because we were in wonderful COVID times. So she couldn't come back for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and so then we went back at 21 weeks, and I was with Gemma for that appointment.
Because I just started a new job, so I was on day two of the new job while Dean and Gemma were having a scan.
Yeah, and so we went in, they did the scan, and then she put the equipment down. And again, that's the moment when you're like, oh, okay, where are we going now? And she just said... I suspect, so there was an abnormality with the heart. I suspect it may be a right aortic arch. But basically, it's kind of a bit of a blur because I think my reaction, my emotional reaction was kind of to switch off because I felt, strangely enough, that I had to be there for Gemma or I couldn't break down because she was doing this amazing thing for us. And I didn't want her to, I don't know, I didn't want her experience to be too devastating, I guess. So there was a brief moment we were taken into another room and then they said, right, we're going to send you to the Evelina in London. And it was when they told us, all right, okay, you're going to go tomorrow. And Gemma did cry, bless her, and she was saying that, oh, it must be really bad if they're sending us tomorrow. And I was like, we just need to wait and see what it means. And, you know.
So then they call me and tell me, and then I spend the next 4 hours, like, horrifically researching on Google of what right aortic arch is, because I'm not going to be able to go. Did I go to the appointment?
I think you did.
Yeah, I did. We went to the appointment the next day. So I was like, oh my God, what's a right aortic arch? Because I know all of these words, but I don't actually know what it means. So I was researching it for the next, like, 4 hours until Dean got home. Then we went to the appointment the next day, all drove up to London. So we drove to Gemma's, then drove up into town and parked there.
And they explained to us at that point that it just meant that the plumbing was slightly different, that her arch went to the right instead of the left, and therefore it could possibly wrap around her esophagus and restrict her airways, affect her feeding. But generally, it wasn't a big issue. But it could be a sign of Q22 deletion, which has previously been known as DeGeorge's syndrome. And so they asked us if we wanted an amniocentesis to find out whether or not she had that. Now, previous to this, we'd always said our decisions as a team and what we came up with in our agreement session was that we're very pro-choice. And basically, if the doctors at any point said that it would affect quality of life then we would terminate the pregnancy. Again, added complication because it was twins.
And there was the added complication of the amniocentesis because it was twins, and they couldn't necessarily give us a lot of information on it because it was like, we don't do them that often with twins, so we can't give... Normally, they're like, there's this percentage of risk. It was more of a... you could do this, but we're not sure. But then they also said with DeGeorge's syndrome, we weren't aware of it. It's the second most common chromosome
issue
behind Down syndrome, but it's very rarely diagnosed because it's such a wide spectrum disorder that you don't normally see it. Like, it could be very mild autism, or it could be like a huge amount of developmental issues or various different ones, but it goes quite undiagnosed. But because it was a spectrum disorder, they basically said, we can do this amniocentesis and we can tell you whether she's got Q22 deletion DeGeorge syndrome, but that's all we can tell you. Like, you could be 18 years down the line and then she's got a very mild case of autism, or you wouldn't even know. There's like thousands of people that have got this Q22 deletion and you wouldn't be able to say that they've got it. Or she could be, it could be on the other end of the spectrum. And then at that point, we just kind of... You had a bit of a...
Yeah, that was when I got emotional, actually, because it was at 21 weeks. And I think we had a scan at 17 weeks to know they were girls. And we'd had these names picked out since forever.
Because everyone was like, twin one, twin two. It was like, that's Nora, that's Nave.
Yeah. Because I like Charmed, so I wanted all of their names to be the same, however many, whatever happened in future child rearing.
We was only ever having two.
Yeah. So we came up with a list of names, and Neve and Nora were the girls' names, and Nora and Nate were the boys' names. But yeah, so we'd named them at 17 weeks. And when they said about the amniocentesis, they were very much like, well, you know, if you're going to do anything about this, you need to have the amniocentesis sooner rather than later, because they don't like to terminate pregnancies.
Well, legally, they can't terminate pregnancies.
So I kind of broke down and I was like, well, no, because at this point, I'm already bonded to this child. This is, you know, she's not just a baby. She's Neve, and we love her as she is. And that was before she was born. So. Yeah.
And I think as well, because it was because of the range of the spectrum of it, like, we didn't know. Well, and in our agreement session, it was very much like based on quality of life and then what the doctors would suggest. And the doctors were just a bit like, it's up to you. Like, some people want to know, some people don't want to know. Like, ultimately, it's a spectrum disorder.
So we can't talk about quality of life.
Yeah, can't talk about quality of life. At that point, it was like, okay, we're just going to crack on.
And then it was a lot of scans.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was loads of scans because it was a twin pregnancy anyway. But then there was added scans on top of that. So literally like every other week, Gemma was in hospital for a scan. Then we got offered an MRI scan.
And our approach was always everything. We were very lucky. And I think when you go into surrogacy, the most important thing is making sure that you connect with your surrogate and you have a really good getting to know period, so that you can tell that you're in sync and your beliefs are the same. So every decision we made through the pregnancy, we were always on the same page. But our outlook was, well, you're doing this thing for us. We've got very much the same life beliefs and the same outlook on lots of different things. So whatever you're comfortable with, we will do. And Gemma was quite interested in the MRI, wasn't she? Because she quite likes the science of it. So her approach throughout the pregnancy was always looking at the technology, the sonographs, the everything, really.
Going back to science, so I wouldn't even really call them decisions so much. It was just like, okay, so we're doing this. And it wasn't even a decision. It was like, because we were all on the same page. It was like, okay, we're doing this. Do we want Chinese or pizza for dinner tonight that we're all here for? So that was really, like, there wasn't any stress
there. No, there wasn't anything really. Yeah. But then that being said, Gemma was always like, look, I'm happy to do it if you want to do it. Even with the amniocentesis, which is quite invasive, she was like, if you want it, I'll do it. And then it was like, well, we didn't see the point in it, did we?
No. So then, like,
fast forward really to birth.
That there was no complications with the pregnancy beyond that. Like, there was no anything like that. We was on tenterhooks because obviously it was a twin pregnancy. So it was like, from about 33 weeks, we were a bit like, okay, bags packed.
Yeah, and we'd already decided Gemma had already decided as soon as it was twins that it was going to be a planned cesarean. I think her exact words was that she wasn't pushing two out. Yeah, so it was a planned cesarean and everything kind of went smoothly. We got to be in the room when they were born, which was amazing.
Yeah, Gemma had a few complications.
Yeah, she lost some blood afterwards, quite a lot of blood actually. But, you know,
was fine in the end, but yeah. it wasn't traumatic or anything. It was just she was in the delivery room longer than planned. The girls were born.
They took Neve off to be tested for Q22 deletion because we didn't have the amniocentesis. And it came back months later, actually, that she didn't have that. But what she did have was eye issues. So from a very young age, she looked like she had googly eyes and they were kind of not focusing and going everywhere. And then her development started to be slow. So around 6 months, we spoke to the health visitor and we was like, look, it's been 6 months. There's this list of things that she should be doing that she's not doing. We've got issues with her eyes. And she referred us then
to ophthalmology, physiotherapy and
audiology.
Physio and audio we got very quickly. And
Ophthalmology, they said, was going to be
an 18-month to 24-month wait for a referral on NHS. And at that point, we were just like, no, like that's our main concern. So we booked a private appointment. Luckily with a surgeon who is at Great Ormond Street, but does like one day a week private or one day a month private.
Yeah.
And he diagnosed optic nerve hyplasia pretty quickly.
Yep. And then he referred us to her team. So she was diagnosed about 7 months with optic nerve hyperplasia in the December. And then in the February, we were under his team at Great Ormond Street and we've kind of been with them ever since. And they've just kind of guided us through.
Guided/added another department every time with me. So we're currently under ophthalmology because of her eyes. We're under neurology, neurodevelopment.
Yeah, the neurodevelopmental team.
Endocrinology.
Endocrinology. I think that's it.
But then she's also got physio. She's also got
PT. Yeah, she's got a physio, paediatrician, occupational therapy. You know, there's a whole list, like a massive catalogue of contacts that you end up being involved with. But generally, she's a really happy child. She's so relaxed. The only thing that is the issue at the moment is that, and it's quite common with children that don't have a lot of movement, is that she gets some stomach issues. And so her toileting is irregular. And then because of that, she gets really bad gas pains. So some days she'll be really upset and screaming because she's struggling with, you know, processing wind or toileting. And then other days she's just happy, chilling out, playing with, you know, toys or experiencing the world around her, really.
Thanks so much, Dean and James, for sharing the story of Nora and Neve with us. So I'm going to pass over to Carl and Nick at this point, and I'll pose the same question to you both. If you wouldn't mind sharing your story with us about at what point you found out there were going to be issues with the pregnancy, and then once you found that out, how did it affect you both?
So our first team, we were doing traditional surrogacy and we fell pregnant the first time we tried and found out at Christmas as well. So there's kind of like a sort of that magic to it. And it was like, oh my God, everything's happening so quick. This is amazing. And so I had all that kind of surge of emotions and it was. And then we got to the 12-week scan, didn't we, the NHS appointment.
So we started surrogacy in 2017. We kind of joined early, like March or something, because we looked at adoption, looked at fostering, and it didn't suit. We had the whole visits talking all through, and then we just felt like that wasn't right and wanted at surrogacy. We joined, we were waiting for membership, where surrogate ended up offering before we had our membership. Well, kind of basically trying to get through the membership so we could be part of a team with that surrogate. And everything went great. We did a 3-week feels like so long ago. Did the 3 months get to know, and then pretty much started trying straight away. We were open to both straight and gestational surrogacy, but the surrogate at the time offered to do traditional surrogacy. So we started in haste, and then, like you say, Christmas, it was around Christmas time, kind of the 2-week window. It came as a negative.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And we were like, oh, well, you know, we'll try again in a month. We'll do it again. And then kind of a week later, a few days later, we got a call on Christmas Day from the surrogate saying, basically, we're pregnant. Great. Everything was exciting. Did the 8-week early viability scan.
Yeah.
Everything looked okay then. And then we got the 12-week scan. Everything looked fine in the scan. And then we got...
It was the bloods.
Yeah, we got a call about the bloods and asked to repeat the bloods because there was an anomaly. So I think they'd obviously seen something and thought, we need to just check that this is definitely right.
And they sent us to the RVI, which is like a specialist hospital in Newcastle. So that's when we sort of started to worry about what could this be? What is it? And then this sort of idea, not this idea, but this condition of triploidy sort of came into the narrative at some point. I can't remember when exactly.
Yeah. And I think, in, like you guys were saying about kind of choices and how we wanted to move forward, I think we all, in our agreement, we'd said, like, we'll take doctor's advice, depends on what the condition is, and we'll go from there. And obviously, with the indicator of Edwards and Patel, both of them are life limiting. So we, at that point, were saying, well, we need to understand what that looks like, because for us, like, I think we, in our heads, we were like, we couldn't go through with having a child that we know we're going to lose. Like, the last thing we want is to have a child brought into my life that we love, and then within a year, know that they're definitely not going to be here anymore. And I think that was the difficulty for us. We never want to kind of terminate unless there was an absolute serious reason to. And we even discussed things like Down syndrome and said, if that comes up, we'll live with it. It's not life limiting. They can live happy lives. We'll deal with that. But Edwards and Patel were kind of, we were going to take advice on that. So because the readings were so high, they basically just said, well, again, like yourselves, we can offer you an amniocentesis and find out what it is, and we can work out what the actual issue is. We can see a clearer reading of what might be going on. So we had a lot of discussion with the surrogate about that and whether we wanted to do it, because it, obviously it's invasive, it can cause termination in itself if it goes wrong. So we were all a little bit concerned, but I think we agreed, given what the outcome could be if we didn't know and we could lose.
Because there wasn't a definitive answer, was there? There was, like, they knew something was wrong and we just didn't know what it was. And so without knowing what it was, we felt like we couldn't make the right decision for us, because we sat and had really deep, heavy conversations together as a couple and then as a team about if it was a life-limiting medical condition, what that would mean for us. And, you know, we were thinking potentially one of us would have to give up work, and what that would mean for sort of changes in our life, whether we'd have the right support. And it was all those sort of things that were going through our heads and conversations that we had with Linda, the surrogate, about what that would mean for us. And selfishly, our quality of life, and then what quality of life we could give a child that might be born with complications. So they did the amniocentesis and they didn't get enough of a sample of the baby's DNA. So, like, you go through all of that. And then all the risks of that.
And they said the chances of that happening were very slim.
So. And then did they offer to do it again? And we said no that time because of the risks. And so, I mean, it was awful, really, because we then had to watch our friend go through that for us. And I think, Dean, now James, you were saying, like, it's, you feel like you have to be strong because this woman's given you, like, such a gift and they're doing so much for you, and you kind of hold everything kind of close to your heart and try not to let things show and trying to be strong for the surrogate.
And I think for Linda, she'd never been through anything like that before. No. You always feel like it's your fault. Like, we're at this point because it's our child that's making her have to go through something.
This is happening to you because we want like a baby.
She wouldn't have gone through this if it wasn't for us kind of going through a journey with her. I know that it can't be helped, it can happen anytime, but you get that feeling as an IP that it's your fault and you can't do anything to help or stop or make anything better. And you just have to kind of work through that. And sometimes, like you say, hold your own emotions to help them
be strong get through it as well. Thing.
So anyway, that journey, pregnancy.
So that was the amniocentesis. And then we still didn't know what the medical condition was with the baby or the fetus inside. And by this point, we were getting on towards sort of 16, 17 weeks pregnant. So it was getting hard, and time was sort of ticking on as to if we needed to make a decision, we needed to know what we're dealing with. Because we were with the RVI in Newcastle, they gave us they've got quite a lot of specialists, and they were using 4D scanning to check for heart conditions and anomalies and things like that, which I think it was fairly new at the time. And there was only a couple of hospitals that were using 4D scans early in pregnancies to identify those things. And the doctor used 4D scanning to look at the baby's brain. And I'm going to do a visual here, and I realize this isn't a visual podcast, but imagine you got your fists together and that represents the two hemispheres of the brain. They're supposed to split like there should be a gap between the two sides of the brain. But in this pregnancy, the separation hadn't occurred, and it was an indicator of certain medical conditions. And the doctor then said that because of the way the brain hadn't split properly, there was likely going to be quite complex learning, if not medical needs, that the baby would have. And the picture that we were given was that the baby would have quite a low quality of life. And for us, we went away and we had to kind of process all that quite quickly and think it all through. And we came to the decision that because of the low quality of life and the low life expectancy that the baby might have, the right thing for us to do in that team at that time would be to opt for a termination. And it was a hard decision to make, wasn't it, really? You had to talk that through with Linda.
I think, when you mentioned the brain foreman, I think they said that was a classic sign of triploidy, didn't they?
Right,
and yeah. I think what they said is the problem with a triploidy pregnancy is the baby sometimes wouldn't go full term and would often kind of miscarry later in the pregnancy anyway.
Yeah.
But there was also huge risks with carrying a triploidy pregnancy, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I can't remember the full things, but I think there was even a mention that it caused cancerous cells development as well. So when we discussed kind of the termination, it was with Linda and her mom there as well, and kind of talked about it as not only kind of the baby's quality of life, but also for Linda, what that would mean for her and how risky it could be for her to continue. So it was never an easy decision in a way.
No.
It was the difficult one to make, but I think definitely for everyone involved.
I think it's sort of, for me, like the universe was talking to us anyway, because Linda did the first part that she had to, and then things started to happen naturally after that anyway. So that, I don't think the baby was very strong anyway, given that. That was, I won't dwell on it too much longer, but that was that pregnancy ended. We took a break as a team, like a break from trying to conceive as a team, tried again a couple more times after that, and ended up with some chemical pregnancies, so very early miscarriages, and then a final miscarriage that ended up at around 10.
It was a twin pregnancy, but there was only two gestational sacs, but no yolk.
And one of them wasn't developing properly anyway.
And it started the...
It was like a misshapen egg sac.
Yeah.
And so we knew that was something amiss there as well.
And that, I think, obviously, we tried four times. But by the end of it, we had about four or five miscarriages, and I think it kind of just, the universe was telling us that something's happening and it's not working. And to be honest, we kind of at that point thought, is surrogacy ever going to work for us? This feels like this is the world telling us that we aren't going to be parents through surrogacy. It's not the right route. Obviously, nothing's going to work. And that was between our kind of, as two gay men, we can both take turns of going. So we both tried, we both had miscarriages, so we just thought it's gotta be us, we are the problem.
Yeah.
We spent, when that kind of team dissolved, we spent about a year just kind of,
because it took all of that across the time we're in a team with Linda took a great emotional toll on all of us and us as well. And I think what we didn't realize at the time was how much of an impact it was having on our mental health, trying to kind of be strong as a team. And I think that's something that we maybe took for granted at the time. And everything was building up and building up and building up. And then the final miscarriage came around the Christmas time in 2018, at the end of that year. Yeah. And so we spent some time sort of reflecting over Christmas with family and just really thinking about what we want. And it was a sad time. It was a really, like, I don't use that sort of glibly. It was a really sad time and quite dark at points trying to figure out what we were going to do next. And we came to the conclusion that for us, the best thing was to take a break and separate from the team and just really try and get ourselves back on track, find each other again.
Yeah, and decide whether, because it had, with all the losses again, like, and like the guys were talking about, you're constantly in that hospital. You're always there. It feels like every weekend is either hospital, but with surrogacy, you've also got to think about each other and trying to find time to do things as a team that isn't just hospital visits, something that's enjoyable. Try and do stuff as the team you set out to be. And all of that was taken toll on us. We never got to see friends. We had to kind of, we're hardly sort of family because everything was just all consumed. So the culmination of all that, we just said, like, after Christmas, we need to just stop and take time ourselves to just live life that wasn't surrogacy for a while and get back together and see where we were.
That was that team.
Yeah.
That was that team. And then we met Gemma in summer-ish of 2019.
think we took a huge break. I started looking at the independent groups, thinking, is that a route for us? Like, do we look at adoption, whatever? And then we decided to jump back in, and we hosted a social, didn't we?
Yeah.
In our local town. And we had a few people come up, and we never met Gemma, although we had met Gemma.
I'd met her briefly at a different social.
Yeah, we saw her in
heavily pregnant, sat in the corner, like, look, I'm sick of my life, to be honest. I'm not all of this. She's just like, so it was a hot day as well.
So then at our social, she was there with her daughter and her mum, and we chatted for a little while along, trying to kind of keep everyone else in. And then I think we got a call a few weeks later.
Yeah.
And it was Dawn basically saying someone wants to get annoying. And then she's like, have you got an idea? And we didn't. We had no idea. But in the back of our heads, we're like, oh, it's Gemma. it was Gemma, thankfully. And she literally, I think she met with...
A different Gemma, I should say. Not the same Gemma as the guy.
There's a lot of Gemmas in this UK. And then she'd basically finished. She'd just given birth. And she was in her...
So in SUK, I think, I might get this wrong, but Sarah or someone will tell you. Surrogates have to have like a certain break after giving birth before they can offer another couple to help or a single person to help. And Gemma was waiting for that day. And as soon as like the day came, I think it was like maybe say 3 months, as soon as the day came, she was like, right, bring the guys.
So we had a great getting to know, like, I think the thing with Gemma, like, it just instantly clicked, didn't it? We always got like, we just get on so well. It's so easy. Like Abby, our daughter, it's just, I don't know. It's just like, it's always felt like just so natural. And it just made everything so much more easy. But with the first time we got pregnant with Gemma, I think people have a chemical.
Yeah.
And we thought, here we go again. We're going to go down the same route. It'll be the same thing. And then the next time was awesome, wasn't it? So we got pregnant, everything great, we had an EV scan, everything looked healthy, perfect, like we started to get a bit more excited. I mean, we're still kind of reserved because obviously we got that point previously.
We had history, so we were always like a little bit reserved about how the pregnancy was going.
But everything looked good. So we got the 12-week scan and everything looked fine, like all the scanning done, perfect, everything great. And then one of the blood markers came back with a high chance of Down syndrome, but it was like 1 in 150.
Most people will get a result of like 1 in 10,000, 1 in 20,000 or whatever. And we were like, oh, that's only like a 0.1% chance or something. And didn't really think anything of it. And I think for us, it's because a medical condition like Down syndrome isn't life limiting. And we'd always talked between ourselves and said, if it was a child with Down syndrome, that's probably something that we would be able to cope with and handle. Yeah, so we didn't really think anything of the good result. And it wasn't confirmed because it was only a high chance. And so onwards, we went with the pregnancy. And later on, sort of towards the 20-week scan, there were high levels of fluid in the uterus. And the doctors were kind of concerned about that, and because it obscured some of the readings and some of the scans that they were trying to do. And from there, Gemma had to go back quite regularly to get additional scans to check on the levels. In retrospect, that can also be a sign of a baby with Down syndrome in the womb. But again, we didn't have that confirmed diagnosis at that time. And Gemma was relatively healthy throughout the pregnancy anyway. And other than the concern about the fluid levels, everything was going all right. And they, on one of the scans, they said to us that they looked like there was a hole, or did it say a hole in the brain?
No, it was a hole in the skull.
A hole in the skull on one of the additional scans. And they're like, oh, you're going to have to go to Leeds. You must get this like looked at. And so we had that additional stress and we were like, oh my God, what's this going to be? So we had to go to Leeds hospital to get an additional scan. COVID, only one of us was allowed in. So Nick was sat in the car while I went in with Gemma. And they did the scan at Leeds and they said, oh no, everything's fine. Okay. And this was actually like 35 weeks into the pregnancy. We worked out, remember what we talked about? It was about 35 weeks into the pregnancy. And we were like, oh, okay, well, because of all this extra stress and we've had, things might happen early, we should just be prepared. So we had our bags packed and things like that. And then at 36 weeks exactly,
Gemma said on the Friday afternoon, because she's a childminder, on the Friday afternoon, she kind of said, basically, she knows her body and she knows what, like, she'd always kind of send us the videos of her moving and all that stuff. And she knew when he, like, if she sat down, he was going to kick, and she always knew when he was going to move. And she sent me a message on the Friday saying, he's not moving. I've booked to go to the hospital, just get a check out. She's like, don't worry about it. I'm sure it'll be fine. Nothing to worry about, but I'm just going to go and check.
She said he wasn't dancing with the pink music that she kept playing to the belly buzz. So.
He wasn't moving as usual. So she went to the hospital and she sat for a while and we were like, oh, we'll just keep an eye on it. And then I think she messaged saying, oh, she rang and she said the doctor has just come and listened and he's not moving. And she, obviously she was upset. And she said, basically, they said if they can't get him moving soon, then it's going to be emergency C-section. Gemma's never had a C-section before. And we always talking about kind of a natural birth and all the, like, all the fun that would come with that and making sure that we weren't going to get on Gemma's nerves when she was giving birth.
In labour.
And then I think it was typically in the middle of horrendous snow. I started clearing the car a little bit just in case you were still at work. And then within 5 minutes, she rang back, didn't she? In tears. So
she said, I think she'd rang at like 4:30 to say she was still waiting to be seen.
Yeah.
And she rang...
it was maybe about 15 minutes later or something.
No, that was for the doctor. Right, and then she rang at like 6:00 and she's like, there's something amiss. If we don't figure out, they might have to do an emergency cesarean. So he ran out to the car, started scraping snow off the car. And he was still scraping snow off the car when Gemma rang back and she's like, I'm going in now. And we were like, what? So I like logged off work, closed the laptop, grabbed the bags, jumped into the car, made it very quickly to York.
And then basically...
But all that time, we didn't know, did we?
Yeah.
So that was it. After that, we didn't know anything. So Gemma had gone down for surgery for the section.
Gemma didn't have anyone with her. She was by herself because obviously she was forced to go for a
routine. Our daughter was with family friends. Yeah.
So we had no idea whether Gemma was okay, whether the baby was okay.
Yeah.
Got to the hospital. I told you to just jump out of Algon Park.
Yeah.
You were trying to find out where to go. And I think we just ran down numerous corridors.
Yeah.
Stood at one door where some girl had pressed the button and was waiting to go in. And I was like, do you mind?
And it was like, and by the way,
pressed every button we could.
All the buzzers.
They let me in and the kind of looked at us like idiots or two men running through a hospital thinking, what's going on here? I managed to speak to someone and we said, oh, we're here for Gemma. And she's like, I'll just go and check. Came back and said, yeah, you can come through. But said, I'll take you to this waiting room. And just sat in a waiting room for about 5-10 minutes before anyone
really before anyone came to see.
So we were sat there like, what's the problem? Yeah. What's like, is everything okay? And then someone just came in and said, congratulations. And we were like, oh, so everything's okay. At least like the baby's okay. And the first response was, how's Gemma? Like, can't talk how Gemma's, is she okay? Like, yeah, Gemma's doing fine. And then eventually we got let in the room with Gemma. But the baby wasn't there.
Yeah.
And obviously Gemma was shaking because she's the effects of just having a baby taken out.
And I think it was the
blood loss as well.
The drugs as well, wasn't it? The, epidural.
But she said he's been taken away. And because of COVID, they kind of said basically as soon as we left Gemma, we couldn't go back. So obviously we could go and see Orson, but we couldn't go back to Gemma. So we kind of spent a few minutes with her. And by then, our friend had arrived because Orson was born within 15 minutes of...
Yeah, literally Orson. Like the phone call. 15 minutes into the section, he was out.
Yeah.
But it was like, so we were in the room with Gemma, and I think obviously we knew we were there obviously for a baby and to have a baby, but in that moment we were just so locked and concerned about Gemma's sort of well-being. It was like, well, is Gemma okay? What's happened to Gemma? And then we got to spend time with Gemma in the room that she was in, and it was Gemma who said the doctors think that he does have Down syndrome. And that was kind of all she knew, wasn't it? Because she'd only briefly seen him and then they'd whipped him away because he needed recess breaths.
Yeah.
And so we sort of knew that there was a baby and the baby was alive. And Gemma was well. And it was all just a bit...
Manic.
Yeah, I don't know what else to describe it as. And then we kind of... It was still delayed a little bit because of COVID. And we didn't want to leave Gemma because we knew we wouldn't be able to go back and see her. And she'd just been through major surgery for us. In an instant's notice without really planning for it. So we said bye to Gemma and then they took us through to see Orson. And there was just this little creature in an incubator sort of like wiggling around and full of life really, wasn't it? He was born exactly four weeks early. And we spent 2 weeks in Skibbo in the special care unit.
Traveling down to York
every day.
Did do an overnight in the Hilton, but during COVID, we ran numerous hotels, and I think it was Holiday Inn I spoke to, and I said, can we stay over? It was kind of where you could only stay in a hotel for a business reason, like a critical reason.
Yeah.
And I said, can we stay over? We have a family member in hospital. And they said, well, that's not really adequate. It's not covered under the government rules.
Yeah.
That's for a pleasure reason. I was like, I'm not being funny, but it couldn't be any
more. Emergency cesarean is not pleasurable.
And sickness much happened. So we decided to just travel every day. And then
there was a lot of busy time, wasn't there, in those 2 weeks, because Austin was struggling to feed, and they said he was very likely to have Down syndrome. They did the genetic.
I think it was the difficulty was the first doctor. She was very matter of fact. She didn't have any bedside manner. And she said, we've looked, and she said he had a widespread toe, which is an indicator, which
it was still about the physical markers of Down syndrome.
Which Carl has, so we're like, well, we're not too concerned. She said he had a single palmar crease, which he doesn't, and he still doesn't to this day, never had. And she said a few other things, but she was like, and we were like, well, are you sure? And she's like, you just need to be prepared. But it was very cold. It wasn't very like, it was just like, you need to accept the fact that he's probably got Down syndrome, rather than kind of like, you know, this could be a thing, we'll do some tests and we'll check and we'll make sure, whatever. So we were a little bit kind of frazzled with all that. And then
did the blood test, genetic test, and that came back maybe 5 days later, I think, and confirmed that he did. And it was, you know, it was fine because it kind of had always been in the back of our heads, and we always knew that we would be comfortable having a child with Down syndrome. And so it was just the rush of the kind of like the emergency situation and trying to like get all that pressure and stress to settle and enjoy being parents still.
Yeah.
He had difficulty feeding at times, didn't he? So talk about like putting a feeding tube in and stuff like that.
But I think the one thing with Down syndrome, whenever, and it's throughout the community that parents who have children with Down syndrome, it's not like as soon as you enter that hospital and you're told your child has Down syndrome, it's not celebrated. They basically, the word they use is almost apologetic. It's not a kind of congratulations, you've got a child. Yeah. They've got Down syndrome. So you're already in it, like the hospital's in a defeatist attitude with you because you're kind of like, well, I've still got a child. They're still alive. They're still healthy. Like everything else aside from the Down syndrome, they're actually a child. They've been born and they're healthy. And it's kind of some of the stuff that positive about Down syndrome and Down syndrome Northeast and kind of all the Down syndrome kind of communities are trying to change that with hospitals and give it a bit more of a celebratory thing rather than coming with the negative straight away. So aside from being there 2 weeks and dealing with that, we had all that to handle. And then on the plus side though, with Orson's diagnosis of Down syndrome, quite often they have heart conditions. They immediately did checks for his heart. And
it wasn't immediate though, remember?
Once they'd confirmed it, they did. They went to the centre for an ECG. And then they took him in a room and kind of basically explained that he had a VSD.
A large VSD.
Large VSD, and it would likely need surgery.
Ventricular septal defect.
Yeah. So they said, obviously, we need to prepare for that. And again, we didn't get a lot. They kind of give a leaflet because we're in York. Gave a leaflet for the local group and said, there you go, check that out, like go and find out what you need to know. And then that was it. And we didn't
imagine walking through like a church fair or like a summer fair thing, and people are like just handing out leaflets, like, oh, here, try this. It was like that, like, there wasn't really any support.
So that side of it was a bit like,
here's a leaflet, off you go.
York Skibu, the staff were fantastic.
No, they were, yeah. They were super, in respect of Down syndrome.
They did everything to help support and were they were very supportive of our situation through surrogacy. They were very supportive of our situation with a child with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And they kind of helped us, especially Christina, one of the student nurses at the time. She was phenomenal. Like, she gave us so much support and help with through those 2 weeks, didn't you?
I think the shock for me, at least, was the heart condition, because it wasn't picked up on any of the scans. And bear in mind, we had a lot of extra scans during that pregnancy because of the high levels of fluid and stuff, and it just wasn't ever picked up. There was the thing with the brain or the skull.
But they did say that there was a bit of an issue with the flow between...
The placental flow, not the heart.
Yeah, true. But it could have been the heart.
It could have been, but the heart... was supposed to be fine.
So I think after, like, I think it was once we got the actual diagnosis of Down syndrome, though, we headed home that night and I just broke down, didn't I?
Yeah.
Not for the here and now, I was like, we've got a happy little healthy child. Like, he's great. But I think I just always looked to the future and I was like, what is his life going to be when we're not here? Like, will he ever love? Will he ever get married? Will he ever, will he have children? Like,
you were grieving for the future, weren't you?
Yeah. Who's going to support him when we're not here? Who's going to be there for him? Like, we'll always look out for his interests while we're here. But when we're gone, who's going to do that? And that was the hard thing.
Whereas I'm quite the opposite. I'm like, let's deal with the situation here and now, and it's all going to be fine, and we will join all these groups, and sort of just looking online for things like that and looking for support groups. That 2 weeks was a very busy period, and it was hard because we couldn't easily see Gemma during that time, and the hospital were really great. And when it was like quiet times, and sort of like literally the middle of the night, I think one of them was, they sort of brought Gemma round so she could see Austin again, because she hadn't seen him since he'd kind of been taken out of her. And then after that, that was maybe in the first couple of days. So Gemma then didn't see him again until
he was
2 weeks old when we'd left the hospital.
Yeah.
That was hard as a team because we'd been really close and we'd spent a lot of time together. And it was nice to be able to check out of the hospital together and leave together and go back to Gemma's and let her daughter meet Orson. And that was sort of like the birth story, really, wasn't it? And it was after that where our lives changed and started.
Tell us a little bit about your children now that we're a few years down the line. What are their personalities like and how are they progressing?
They're just so funny. And what's lovely at the moment with having twins and Nora being able-bodied and developing typically is her response to Niamh. And she's at the moment is so lovely. She just tells everyone, Niamh, sister, Niamh's my sister. And she's very affectionate with Niamh. I share a lot on social media. So there's like videos of her kissing Niamh and cuddling Niamh. And that's quite cute.
Yeah.
And then one of the not so funny things, but I love it, is it started off as a bedtime thing that when they got out of the bath, Nora's quite hyped and she'd scream. And I'm talking Mariah Carey whistle tones, like this scream would smash windows. And Niamh loves high-pitched noises. So it's like they're a match made in heaven. And Nora will scream, Niamh will laugh, and then Nora laughs and says, ah, funny, Niamh funny, and, you know, Niamh finds it funny. So that now gives Nora more reason to scream, which means we can be in the middle of a Costa, and Nora will do the Mariah Carey whistle tone scream, and she thinks she can do it whenever she wants because Niamh finds it hilarious. So that's, I mean, that's quite funny.
Yeah, and then Niamh also, one of my first, she hasn't done it for a couple of weeks, but she does, I call them pterodactyl noises that she will
Oh, yeah. So not only do we have Nora's screams, we have Niamh's screams.
She'll do like these, the only way I could describe it is pterodactyl noises.
Yeah, and dinosaur, guttural.
Guttural, but high pitched as well. And then she'll just laugh about it. Like, she'll make this, and sometimes she's, because the girls share a room at the moment till we move house and they get their own rooms. Nora will be like passed out. She doesn't nap through the day. She stopped napping at 13 months. That was great. Like, we've got a toddler who does not nap. So she's passed out. And then Niamh's in bed doing these pterodactyl noises for about half an hour. She's just laughing her head off at them.
She laughs at herself a lot. And that's, she reacts to herself a lot as well. Yeah. So when she does get upset, another thing, so I put together like a compilation of her laughing and I play that back to her and it calms her down, and loads of people comment on how, like, what a wonderful expression of kind of self-love to kind of hear yourself, and it settles her and calms her. She loves the sound of laughter anyway, so I can play like a video on YouTube of babies laughing and then she'll be laughing back, and so it's like this echo tone of just baby laughter, which is gorgeous.
Or if you're laughing in the house, like, she'll, like, if anyone's like laughing, then she'll start laughing. I was like, oh, she's not that funny. Nora will be like, Niamh, find it funny.
Yeah, she's always saying, Niamh, funny, funny, Niamh.
Oh, that's lovely. Very sweet. So I'll pass the same question over to Carl and Nick.
What's life like now? I think we, James Dean, have collected a series of specialists with Orson. Everything from speech and language, physio. We're waiting on an OT referral. We've got the specialist families that you consult in.
Portage.
portage input, which is for like sensory play development. We've got the cardiac specialist from the hospital for his heart condition, where he had his corrective surgery at 3 months old. So all of this is just forming part of our regular life. So everyone's like, oh, I'm taking the kids here, there, and everywhere. And I'm like, oh, can't that day. We've got an appointment with so-and-so.
Yeah, I think last week we had an appointment every day. And then he's got therapy. He's private speech therapy. He's the charity that does his...
the conduct of education.
Yeah.
So all these things that our son, older son, awesome, needs that other typically developing children don't necessarily have input on. But we just take it in our stride. I think people have commented about us as well. We're quite laid back with it all and we just sort of roll with it because it's
pointless getting stressed about.
Yeah.
Because, to be fair, and probably like you guys, like it's all we've ever known. Like, Awesome's our first child. You've got obviously the two, but you have always had that. When you've had children, you've always had a child that needs those things, and it's your normal. So I think we're fortunate that Awesome's were first, because our normal has been that, and we're very much set up in that way. We plan our days around what he does, and we'll split, and one will do something with Felix to keep him busy while the other one takes Awesome to a session or whatever. But yeah,
it's quite interesting. So we've got Orson, who's just over 2.5, and he will sleep for England if you let him. He is going to be that teenager that will not get out of bed. Like, and people, too, that Lana does. So people worry, I think, about what a child with Down syndrome might be like. But we have a sassy 2.5-year-old who is full of attitude and who is given every bit of the terrible twos. He's waving at me now as I'm talking about him. He's given every bit of the terrible twos that a typical child would give, so we're not missing out on anything in that respect.
And he's very switched on. Like, I think a lot of people expect kids with Down syndrome to kind of just like sit idly and not really kind of know what's going on, but Orson, he listens to everything you say, and you can see he's watching what you're doing. He'll give Makaton back to you of what you're saying and doing. He'll tell you what he wants. He's just so switched on with things.
Yeah.
He just knows what's going on, and he knows his dog TV. He knows his dog that
we've found ways of communicating with him. We use a lot of Makaton and he picks it up really well. So that's helped us a lot with the communication side of things. We've got, so he still naps for England, and he will sleep 3 hours in the middle of the day if you let him. We don't, we wake him up. Where we've got Felix, his brother, who is 7 months old and barely sleeps. So like, it's like chalk and cheese, but the bond that they have, I think, is something that shocked me. Well, it shocked both of us, but I definitely was taken aback by it, because Felix being typical, I didn't expect him to develop so quickly, if that makes sense. And the guy, you guys have probably seen it, like in the contrast between the twins, but Felix is already crawling and Awesome still bum shuffles and doesn't want to walk unless you absolutely make him. So Felix is crawling. He stood up, pulled himself up against something last night for the first time. And I was like, you're 7 months old. What are you doing? And the way he looks for Orson on a morning, so you carry him downstairs or bring him in the room, and he's like looking around for him.
Or
and
even it's just, Orson or
go like, also do like the marathon sign for brother. And it's just like, it's those bits that are just really like heartwarming to see, aren't they?
But Orson's the same. Like, so Orson, Makaton is like, he's not fully verbal. He'll try words and he'll say like, you'll try like squirrel and like, and
dad. I mean, of the words, squirrel's like a hard one. Like, he does dad, dada.
He knows a lot of words, and he attempts a lot of words, and that's why we're seeing speech and language to kind of work through that. But he knows like, absolute, like he picks up Makaton so easily from other people. Like, when he comes home from nursery and he does something like, what is he saying? We haven't taught him this. Where's he got this from? But also he's been toilet, like using the potty since.
Yeah. So this, I mean, kids of any sort of need and ability have variations in their toilet training. But one of the things that they encourage with children with Down syndrome is to start toilet training earlier.
Perhaps they're right from about 9 months.
Because it can sometimes take them longer. But we started putting them on the potty when we were on holiday last year. Well, it was on the toilet. I just sat him on him one day and he did his business. And every day since then, he has done.
He's second.
He's number two. on the toilet or on the potty. Apart from when once or twice when he was unwell. But so that's been like a massive sort of milestone to celebrate for us, and people are kind of like awed by it and like in awe of it, aren't they? Like, oh my god, he can do that, or he can do this. And I think people are shocked by what children with Down syndrome can actually achieve and accomplish when you put this mechanism's in place to allow them to achieve.
I think a lot of, especially with Down syndrome, a lot of kind of people's opinions are built on kind of adults with Down syndrome who possibly didn't have the amount of support that they, like the kid, our kids get now. So there's obviously people in their 60s and like that aren't verbal at all and kind of and haven't possibly got as much development as what our kids have now. But times have changed and we have a lot more support. We're taught marathon from an early age. Like they have all these groups. The amount of support we have for us, and if we didn't have it, it would be very difficult to kind of maneuver through that world yourself. And I think people are always put off by, I mean, at the end of the day, everyone wants their kid to be perfectly healthy and no issues. That's everyone's ideal. But actually, like you said, and like you guys said, like you feel like the child you have was meant for you because of your outlook on life. Like, we take everything in Orson's stride, we follow him, we do what he wants and we work around him. But equally, we don't let him get away with stuff. He's still disciplined when he's naughty. We don't allow him to walk all over us and get away with stuff just because he has Down syndrome. He's still checked like every child when it comes to, if he's doing something naughty, we tell him off and
we're lucky to have Austin in our lives, and our lives are more like rich because of having Austin.
We probably look at the world differently because of him, and in a better way.
In a better way.
Well, that's lovely to hear. We're going to make a turn away from the niceties, the lovely things, for a moment, and move on to some of our patented Twitter trolls. I often just read these out for the kind of knee-jerk reactions that you guys have to give, because these are obviously fraught with misconceptions. So here's our first. Surrogacy is wealthy intended parents paying for a healthy baby that they then abandon if they're not perfect.
Me and Dean's joke when we joined SUK is that we were the poor gays. I think we came into it quite young. But I mean, not so much now. I think there's a lot more younger people joining SUK. But when we joined SUK 2016,
we were
2017. We were looking into 2016, 20. So I was only 27, you were 28. And like, we were going to these social events and we were like meeting like lawyers and
in their mid to late 30s, and, like, some even in their 40s.
Dean had only like trained as a teacher for like 2 or 3 years. I was only a manager in advertising. And we were like, I feel a little bit out of my depth here. And so like, we were very lucky that we had the kids at the age that we did. We're not rich at all. Like, we rent, we don't own our own house. Like,
we're now eligible for a council property, which, because, again, that's, you know, not we're not rolling in money if we're eligible for council housing.
And that's all because of Neve's needs and the adaptation she's going to need for the house and stuff like that. So like, it's we were never the rich.
I think the thing is, people always try to criticize things they don't understand, and so you get quite ignorant messages from those people. And actually, if you research it, you'll see that, you know, especially in the UK, it's altruistic and it's all about friendship, and it's just a friend doing a huge thing for a set of friends. And, you know, like Gemma now, so our Gemma is, you know, we still see her once a month. She does see the girls, but she wants to see us. You know, our best night out in the last kind of year or so, we went axe throwing at Christmas, and well, we didn't take the girls there because it's not really appropriate, but we, you know, we had drinks, we threw axes, and we had a really good time. And so I think people then, because they don't understand something, go on this path to try and demonize things or fight things, and it's just not necessary. What would I say to someone that it's just rich IPs that want a healthy baby? Well, the flip side to that again is, as I've mentioned to friends before, the media will always try and
sensationalize
something, or again, demonize minorities. And as gay men, we are one of those minorities that sometimes get attacked unnecessarily. But we are just like any other people, you know. We're not these aliens, and we're not devoid of emotions, and we go into surrogacy because we have this desire to have a family and to have children. And it's the same as any straight couple having children, that your desire is to raise a child, and you're going to have complications in any journey, even with a typically developing child. And if, you know, you would never see in a newspaper that, oh, you know, this horrible woman has just left her, has abandoned her disabled child because she's only interested in healthy children. You know, like I said, with our story, Niamh, we knew that she was Niamh before we found out. And we had no intention of aborting that pregnancy, nothing to do with the fact that it was twins, but just with the fact that we was ready to have children and we knew that it was Nora and Niamh and we wanted them regardless of any issues there may be.
That's great, thanks. Carl and Nick, do you have anything further to add to that?
Yeah, I think we would also say that we were one of the poor ones because we our first journey, we borrowed some money to kind of start surrogacy.
Yeah.
We weren't earning a lot at the time. We've kind of worked our way up promotion wise to get a little bit more money to support at the minute, but we are certainly far from rich. And we walked in this journey kind of, we just want to be parents. Like, it didn't matter to us. Like, everyone wants to have a child. No one wants the child to have a disability or anything wrong with them. But equally, like, we were ready to just be parents and it didn't matter what that came with. Whether, like, we already said, if Down syndrome was something that came up, we'll deal with it. It's a child at the end of the day. And I think just on the whole, like, it's not just kind of about disabled children, but what people forget, and going back to the altruistic side of surrogacy in the UK, like, a lot of the people, straight couples especially, who turn up to surrogacy have been through a plethora of heartache and trying themselves, and they're everyday individuals who are only on this journey because they haven't been able to conceive through normal routes, and they aren't always people who are wealthy. They're your next door neighbor. There's someone down the road. They're people who work a normal job who are just trying to have children through a route that allows them to still be biologically linked to a child. And yes, there is other routes, adoption, fostering, and things like that. But again, it's about people's want to have their own children. Those people who will sit there and troll on the internet and say, everyone, like, all these people are going to get rich and whatever, are they adopting those children? Are they fostering children? Are they having their own children?
While you're saying that, and again, I don't know if this will make the cut, but I must throw in there, there's some brilliant videos on TikTok, and I absolutely love the one where people go outside of an abortion clinic to protest, and there's a man in particular that I'm thinking of, and he goes, oh, okay, so if you're against abortion and you're, you know, you're not pro-choice, would you adopt a child? Would you take one of these children on? And nearly all of these protesters are like, no. Yeah. So you, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But then I also think, like, going back to, like, SUK and going to these, I think me and Dean were probably a little bit brainwashed by the media in the sense that when we went to our first SUK event, we were like, oh, it's just going to be full of all these fabulous gays, like, just, like, jaunting around this pub. And then we went there and, like, we met all of these, like, couples that have had, like, some horrific stories to get to SUK, and it really humbles you and you realise, like, people come to SUK in a very different journey. And like, when these trolls, like, say, oh, you're just going to leave, like, the child, it's like the journey that people go to, especially in the UK, I know it's very different if you've got that wealth and, like, you can just go to America and do it, but the journey in the UK for people to get to surrogacy and get to that child, like, nobody's giving that child back. Like, giving back is completely the wrong phrase entirely, but, like, nobody's leaving the child with the surrogate. Like, the minute you've conceived, you're like, oh, that's our child. Like, that's the mindset straight away. Is, I don't think it even comes into IP's
heads. I think if I could give any message to trolls and haters, I would say, you know, we should all be grown up enough to know there are good and bad in every walk of life. And before you criticize or you throw hate towards a minority or a journey to parenthood, before you criticize anything, you should educate yourself, you know, and talk to people that have actually been through it rather than reading these crazy headlines, you know.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I think we can consider that myth thoroughly debunked now. Lastly, before we go, what advice would you have for any intended parents that are just starting out on their surrogacy journey, or for any intended parents who have recently come up against unexpected complications on their journey?
I think I'd almost take a step back from that and make sure that if you're going into surrogacy and you're going through this journey, like really look at the agreement session and really make sure you're on board. Like I think we, one of the benefits of surrogacy, and me and Dean talked about it quite a lot, is that when you're going through the agreement session, this is not something that straight couples have, or like people like atypical pregnancies have, because you just get pregnant and like your mindset is that everything's going to go okay. But by going through the agreement session and talking to the surrogate, you are faced with those realities even before you conceive of what you're going to do in this situation and what you're going to do in that situation. I think it's really important that you thoroughly go through that and like sit down with a bottle of wine or sit down with like a cup of coffee, like as a couple, like even before you like get into a surrogacy agreement and like realize like what are your thoughts on that and where do you see, like almost imagine yourself like if we were in that situation, what's going to happen with that. And
and make sure they're aligned with your surrogate as well, and that you are, you know, spend time with it in a long appropriate getting to know session so that your thoughts are aligned. And if you know, if you aren't with SUK and you're doing it for an independent role, or exactly what James said, because we're referring to an agreement session, which is specific to SUK, but anyone entering any kind of parenthood journey, really, make sure you have those conversations, because they will inform so much of it.
Yeah, and I think that by taking that step back, when you are confronted with it, it's not as much of a shock, because you've already had that conversation, you've already had that realization of what you're going to do. And like don't be afraid to grieve or like mourn or of like this ideal situation that you've had, but before you're confronted through that, you should have already mentally figured out what you're going to do in that situation, so it shouldn't come as such of a shock. And it's like preparation is the key in surrogacy anyway, but really preparing is going to be great for you.
Yeah, I think for most things, preparation is key, let alone one of the biggest things you'll do in your life. So that's very solid advice. Carl and Nick, what advice would you have for any intended parents embarking on their surrogacy journey?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Preparation is key, and you should have all those thorough conversations beforehand. But I think if you are faced with a diagnosis that perhaps you weren't expecting, whether it's pre or post birth, it's really important to take time, if you're a couple, as a couple, and think about what that means for your life and what the impact of that would be. But also think about your support network, whether that's friends and family, and also what support groups are out there as well, because I think often there's more support available than you think there is.
Yeah, we didn't know about the world of like positive about Down syndrome, the Down syndrome Northeast that we are part of now. And if we didn't have them now, we would be in a very different place with Austin. But just kind of like you say, when you get faced with that, just take some time to research what that means. Think about whether one of you may have to quit work. Thankfully, with Austin, we can both work. We've got a good support network. We haven't had to massively change our life in terms of work and things. We can continue. But also, I think one of the things, especially with myself, is you walk into surrogacy as a gay couple with very little, you've had no trauma in the world of kind of children. You've never lost. You walk in as a clean slate. I think obviously a lot of straight couples go through losses to get here. I think as my advice to gay couples would be, just be aware that there are people who are here through trauma. They haven't come here. Like, we have the luxury of coming from afresh, and just be aware that the journey to parenthood isn't straightforward, and it may not be for you. Like, as we have proven, the people on this call, parenthood isn't always straightforward. It comes with its trials and tribulations. And
our surrogate Gemma said this quite a lot. She was like, a lot of people think that surrogacy is this like, you know, glossy storybook and everything goes smoothly. But actually, we are just the same as any other pregnancy. And just because we've come to surrogacy doesn't mean that you're not going to face those risks.
For us, I think just make sure that your team is the right team. Like, Gemma is like family now. We would never be without her. Like, she's always going to be there.
Whether she likes it or not, she's stuck with it. So.
Her and Abby will always be part of our family. They'll always be part of their lives. We went to see Pink with Gemma the other week. It was one of the best times of our lives, and it'll always be. And
for me, just, your world will change whether you have children who are typical or with additional needs or medical conditions, whatever it is, your world's going to change. But if you take the time and you find out what support you've got out there, it's going to change for the better. And we weren't prepared for all the great people who are going to meet through Orson having Down syndrome. And everything that went through the pregnancies has been absolutely worth it because he's here now and being cheeky little chap, aren't you?
Can you say squirrel? Is he squirrel?
I think, again, sorry to keep interrupting. I've always got loads to say. But
you've actually been very good on this.
I've tried. But I think also that's us as couples as well from talking to you on this call. I think another piece of advice would be don't be afraid to be open. Share your thoughts. Don't be ashamed of anything that you're thinking or feeling. Reach out. Because that's when you find the support and that's when you'll find other people's opinions and experiences. And yeah, there will be, sometimes you might have a negative thought or you might, or you might not. But if you don't reach out, you'll never find the support. You'll never find a network of people around you that really get to experience the joy of having a child with needs.
Yeah, I think that is a perfect place to end. So thank you so much for your contributions today, guys. Have you got anywhere our listeners can find you online to follow your journey as it continues?
So again, we've spoke loads on this podcast, but me and James, as I mentioned earlier, are quite open on social media. So if you want a kind of bigger picture of our story, you can search TikTok for Two Dads, Two Babies. And there's like a whole documentary that James's cousin made about our journey. But also I share lots of lovely videos of Neve's, lots of lovely videos of Neve updating her. So again, whether you just want information for the podcast or whether you want to, whether we're allowed to throw a cheeky promote in there, I will.
There's nothing wrong with a bit of self-promotion. Carl and Nick, can we find you anywhere?
We post a lot on social media, but you can add us. We've got like closed profiles, but we do post something we do as a monthly video called 1 Second Every Day, just capturing a snippet of each of the boys' lives. And we've got Orson's from the first month of his life right through to like now.
Yeah,
and it shows his development and our journey with him. And yeah, so that's a good, if you've got like the highlights on my Instagram story, I've got them all. So you can like watch everything at one go.
Well, guys, that's great. Thanks so much for your time on the podcast and wishing you and your families all the best.
Is it bye?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
That is all for this episode of the Surrogacy UK podcast, but keep an eye out for our next episode, which will be out shortly. In the meantime, please remember to follow us and subscribe. Thank you to all our listeners.